Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you for taking time out during midday, midweek. As Fred said, a busy time. And thank you, Fred, for making it possible. And providing lunch. So the topic we have here is professional malpractice, or malpractice, a professional's obligation. And this is a bit of a complicated topic, and it's a broad topic. And I've taught different aspects of it, like medical malpractice is its own field. But what I want to talk about today is one slice of the issue, and that is, what is the obligation of a professional when giving advice? And I'm not only going to talk about the professional, actually. I'm going to frame it in terms of the layperson giving advice and the professional giving advice and the difference between them, what the responsibility is within halacha versus the principles of Ontario law. And I'm also going to try to talk a little bit about how we define negligence. And I want to do this, you have to pick a profession when you do this, because each profession has its own rules, both within secular law and within Jewish law. But I thought I would take investment advisors as a good business ethics case. Much of what I say for investment advisors will have applications for accountants as well. I brought on the sheet. Does everyone have the papers? Okay. So I gave you three sample cases. The first case: David and Ari are leaving synagogue together one Sunday morning, and David asks Ari, a neurosurgeon who dabbles in investing, for advice regarding a particular stock. Right? David and Ari are friends. They schmooze, and Ari is not an expert. He's a neurosurgeon, which we tend to assume means he's a smart person. Maybe, but we assume that. And so David says to Ari, what do you think of Apple or whatever? So Ari suggests buying, and David does so. The stock's value plummets and never recovers. Is Ari liable? Does he have any responsibility for what happened to David's investment? What would you say before we see sources on it? Go ahead.
I would say in secular law, no.
Okay.
Because he's a neurosurgeon. He's not supposed to have any special knowledge in this area.
Okay.
So the answer is no. But also, even if he was like a stock advisor and things like this, where stocks, there's so many factors going into whether stocks are up or not, they're not taking to foresee all these things. And even a stock advisor, if they're advising the situation, the stock goes down, he's not liable necessarily.
Ah.
Especially not because he's a neurosurgeon.
So, Kevin, right?
Yes.
Okay, so Kevin not only answers number one, but suggests an answer to number two. So let's take a look at the second one. Susan is a professional certified investment advisor, and Sally retains her services. And when I say retains, she's paying for her time. Susan advises Sally to purchase a particular stock, noting that all investments carry risk. Past performance is not an indication of future results, and so forth. Sally buys, and the stock's value plummets and never recovers. Is Susan liable?
No, unless she advised, unless I was the one she advised to buy.
Why not?
Again, if she qualified it as, unless she had special knowledge that the company was going to, that there was going to be problems with the company, like a Nortel, something like that. Most people didn't know Nortel was going to go in the down the drain. At least not initially after the split with BCE. But yeah, if she gives a cautious look, this is what I think, but there's no guarantees.
Okay, I think you need to be a little bit more subtle with this question, right? Because there are multiple possible explanations for what happened. One possibility is, indeed, there was information that she didn't have access to. But I think you need to distinguish between negligence and non-negligence.
Between having information she didn't have that was available if she had looked for it.
Exactly.
As opposed to,
right,
you know, just didn't exist.
Right. You have to ask the question of what information should Susan have had, and was her lack of research or lack of basic training, perhaps, what caused her to make this mistake? You know, if there were signs that she should have seen, then what would you say? Then you would already suggest, you know, liability, because she's negligent. So,
can I expand that question?
Yeah.
I want to ask whether the body that certifies Susan as a professional advisor is in any way culpable.
Right. So in secular law, the answer is yes, but there's a step in between. Because generally speaking, there is a firm that is responsible for its dealers, and the firm is the one that will take the responsibility. But if this is somebody independent, and in fact it turns out that they weren't properly trained, then yes, the certifier is the one who's going to have the problem. If they were properly trained, but they just, you know, were irresponsible in the way that they practiced it, that's another story. But those are our opening two cases. The third one I'm not ready for yet. The third one is going to be more in terms of defining negligence. That's what we want to address first, is the question of liability between friends, lay people, and liability between professional and client. So in secular law, it's very clear that there is liability for bad advice in the event that somebody is negligent. As a professional, I'm not talking about a layperson, I'm talking about a professional. If you take a look at source number one, I brought you one of the cases that gets quoted a lot in this, Quantum Financial Services v. Yip. The relationship between broker and client is contractual. This is in, you know, part of the opinion already on the case. The relationship may also sometimes be a fiduciary one. In addition, the broker has a duty of care to the client and may be found negligent if the client suffers damage as a result of breach of that duty. So the key, really, is not so much the question of contractual fiduciary. The question is the magic phrase, duty of care. Duty of care is something that exists not only in a financial services setting. It exists between parents and children. It exists between teacher and student. It exists between doctor and patient. The duty of care is the legal way of saying that you owe someone something. You aren't considered to be two people who happen to be sharing the same space, but there's actually a relationship, and you have to look out for the other party. And in this case, the broker has to look out for the client. It will not exist in the eyes of the law, between two lay people. So if someone comes to me and says, what do you think about Apple? That doesn't create a responsibility for me to do research in order to answer the question. I can't mislead them. I can't present myself as an expert and say, you know, I've gone through dozens and dozens of documents and you know, been studying this for years, and now I believe. I can't pretend something that isn't true. But on the other hand, I have no responsibility to go provide them with the best possible answer. I have no duty to them. As opposed to, again, if I'm a professional, they're my client, they come to me, I'm giving them professional advice, my duty of care says I have to do better for them. That's a secular legal perspective. And that's the underpinning for liability for malpractice. If you don't do that, what you're doing is malpractice. What about within Jewish law? So Jewish law actually recognizes a much broader duty of care, basically between all of us. We have a natural responsibility. If you take a look at source number two, a verse from Leviticus, Vayikra, Lo sekalel cheresh, do not curse the deaf, which is a separate point, not really relevant for us, but it's the beginning of the sentence. Vilifnei iver lo sitein mechshol, do not put a stumbling block before the blind. Ani Hashem, you shall revere God, I am God. And that ending is there on the sentence, as the rabbis explain, in order to teach us that you say, well, the blind person is never going to know who did it. I can get away with whatever. I can always say I didn't intend it, I didn't know, I didn't do it. God says, I'm watching, and I know what your intentions were, and I know what you did. So even though you think you can get away with it, you can't get away with it. But the key is that middle of the sentence. Do not put a stumbling block before the blind, which is really a commandment of don't hurt, essentially, other people. Don't take advantage of other people's ignorance. And it's coupled with another verse, which I didn't bring here because it's less directly relevant to the discussion, but that is Lo sa'amod al dam re'acha, which means, right, don't stand by while someone's blood is being shed. You have a responsibility to intervene. Which means that Jewish law recognizes a duty of care between people. And, you know, because the question always comes up, I'll, you know, headed off now. This line, "Lifnei iver lo sitein mechshol," don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind, is applicable for everybody, Jews and non-Jews alike. It is a human rule rather than a within the family type of a rule. I'm not allowed to do anything that's going to cause somebody to stumble. So if someone comes to me and says, "What do you think of Apple?" I'm not allowed to give him misleading advice. I can say, "I don't know," but I can't, I can give disclaimers, but I'm not allowed to say something that could cause that person to make a wrong move that's going to be damaging for him. Clear?
And I've seen this quote in discussions of the AODA accessibility law with people with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Very, a different direction than what I'm using it right now for, a more literal read. But I think, yes, very important. Do the people who came in after have sheets? Okay, great. Yeah, okay. Yeah, Kevin.
We might get into this later. In this scenario, what if it wasn't you that put the stumbling block in front of the blind person? You're just a bystander, but you see there's a blind person coming and a stumbling block in his path. You have a duty to intervene.
Right, so that's under the second verse, right? Do not stand by while someone's blood is shed, which is not murder specific.
Right.
It's in general. Someone else is going to be harmed. You have to...
You have a duty to act, even though it wasn't you.
Right. Judaism has what Ontario does not in that regard, which is called a duty to rescue.
Right.
Yeah. Jacob.
In case number one, where there is, isn't there kind of an implied lack of responsibility by the first person? As long as there's not some sort of intentional misleading, isn't there a certain expectation that the neurosurgeon is not an expert, and therefore you have to take whatever that neurosurgeon...
Yeah.
Says with a certain grain of salt.
Right, so we have to get to the question of what constitutes blind. In other words, if the person can see but he chooses to shut his eyes, is that my problem? You know, or, for example, if you have a sidewalk in front of your house and the sidewalk doesn't quite match up, one part is elevated above the other. So the city will go through once or twice a year and they'll paint red lines or whatever it is to call it to people's attention. Not everyone's going to see that.
Actually, they're painting those red lines so they will come and actually see
that. Right. Okay. So they're doing it for themselves prior to fixing it. Good. But let's say someone is harmed. Let's say not the case where it's been mended, but someone puts up a sign warning people, bump, or whatever it is. Someone gets hurt. We do have a normal expectation of what people are going to do. And so the neurosurgeon may respond and say, "Why do you go to a neurosurgeon for stock advice? That's not my problem, that's your problem." And we're going to have to deal with that a little bit. So let's move a little bit ahead with this. Generally speaking, even though we have a duty of care within Judaism, one is not liable for giving bad advice. Even though you're not allowed to do it, you can't take someone to court for giving bad advice. That's the general rule. If you take a look at source number 3, you get one example of what one should not do. A very old midrash. This goes back to Talmudic times, a couple of thousand years ago. Haya no tel mimcha itzav. Someone's taking advice from you. He asks you for advice. Al titen lo etza she'ena hogenes lo. Do not advise him in a way that's inappropriate for him. So, for example, don't tell him go out early in the morning, knowing that that's when thieves are lying in wait. Don't tell him to go out at noon. He's going to be overcome by heat. Give him advice that makes sense for him. However, take a look at source number 4, which is where we see that there's no liability for it. Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, also known as Rashba, gives an interesting ruling. There was somebody who had this is a hypothetical case by the time you hit modern times, but someone has an eved. An eved more or less is a slave. Leave aside the whole discussion about biblical slavery and the rules for it and whatever. It's a fun discussion, but not for right now. But somebody has one. His neighbor sabotages him. He goes to the slave and says to him, if you convert to Judaism, he's going to have to let you go. And the slave says, great. And the slave converts. So now the owner comes back to the neighbor and says, you owe me. You owe me the value of the slave. And he says back to him, me? I just spoke. There's no liability for speech. So take a look. He says, if Shimon persuaded, I'm just reading the English in the interests of time. If Shimon persuaded this servant to convert, and he accepted and converted, Shimon owes nothing to the master. for he harmed nothing. The servant converted on his own. Right? You just gave him the idea. And the key part that's relevant for us is this closing part. We never find that one who gives advice is liable in human courts, even for causing harm. There is no liability. If I stop there, it sounds like there's no such thing as malpractice for our bad investment advisor. Right? There's no such thing as liability, it sounds like, for giving bad advice. This is not the end. Because if it were, well, we would enjoy the rest of the food. You know, you're missing about 25 minutes or so. So there is indeed the possibility within Jewish law of a tort of negligence, the claim that somebody was negligent. Even though we just saw the statement that you're not liable for bad advice. And we have to distinguish between two different types of indirect harm, using two Aramaic words that are very similar. One word is grama, and the other word is garmi. Both of them refer to indirect harm. However, grama, the indirect result of one's actions, does not carry liability. Garmi does carry liability. And we'll have to see why there are two different categories and what the difference is between them, but that's what you need to know. So, for example, take a look, please, at source number 5, a classic case. The sage Rabba said, you throw somebody's implement, a vase, whatever it is, off of a roof. However, on the floor, there on the ground, there are a whole bunch of cushions. So at the time that you throw it, nothing should happen to it. It should hit the cushions, land softly, and it won't break. However, somebody else, or even the person who throws it, runs down and removes the cushions. Right? So in order for it to be the thrower himself, maybe he's not at the top of the building. He's standing on the ground. He throws it up in the air, such that it'll land on the cushions, but then he pulls away the cushion before the thing lands. So in such a rule, the Talmud says, he's exempt from liability. Because at the time that he threw the item, it wasn't going to break. Who should be liable in such a circumstance?
The person removing it.
But should that person really be liable? He also caused indirect harm. He didn't throw the thing. All he did was move cushions. He didn't break anything. The other guy threw the thing up in the air. So that when you get to the Shulchan Aruch, when you get to the code of Jewish law on this, take a look. The Hebrew is on the bottom of one side. The English is on the next side. And I'm grateful to Catherine for making the copies. Please make sure to thank her for me. You find the ruling in the Shulchan Aruch. The Mechaber Rabbi Yosef Karo, who is the initial author of the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, writes, if one throws his own implement from a roof, his own implement, over cushions which would prevent it from breaking, and then somebody else comes along and takes away the cushions and it smashes, the Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber, Rabbi Karo, says, the person who removed the cushions is liable. He says you are liable for doing that, for removing the cushions. However, along comes Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who writes the Ashkenazi part of it, and he says no. Some say removal is called grama, it's indirect harm, and one is exempt. And that's indeed the view he follows. And therefore, he writes, even if one throws an implement off a roof over cushions and then personally removes the cushions, so he played both sides of it, he is exempt. In other words, I took Jacob's glass, I threw it in such a way that it should land on pillows, and then I removed the pillows. So I did both pieces of it. But at the time that I threw it, it would have been fine. And in removing the pillows, I didn't actually break the glass. I'm exempt from liability.
Intent has no part in that?
Intent has zero part in it. Even with intent, I shouldn't have done it. From a, you know, God perspective, I'm in trouble, as we'll see in a moment. But in terms of what the courts can punish, nothing.
Throw the glass up in the air, knowing I'm throwing it in the air and I'm going to pull the cushion out.
Doesn't matter. Yeah.
Can I get a similar but yet more stark case?
Yeah, go ahead.
Let's say you see your friend jumping on a trampoline, and you pull the trampoline away, and he falls to the ground and breaks his leg.
Yep.
Would that be the same case, and you still would not be, we would still say you are not liable for injuring this person? After all, he was the one who jumped. You simply removed the trampoline away.
So I'm not 100% sure, but I don't see why it should be any different.
Okay.
I want to think about it a little bit, and that's actually a good point because I forgot to send around the sign-in sheets. If you sign in with your email address, you'll get the follow-up from me on this, and I intend to look into the trampoline case in case anyone's planning on doing that. You should first, get my email.
It may be different because the fellow who started the jump actually had the trampoline under him.
In the cushion case, the cushion was there.
I'm bounding the person who's actually touching what he's supposed to land on. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to land, I jump on this, I'm supposed to land on this. When I go up, I'm coming down.
Right.
So the person who loses.
I don't know. That's another story. If he's on the trampoline when I pull it, then for sure I have a problem. Then I actively harmed him. I knocked him over. But I'm not sure.
How about an even more stark example? Let's say you see somebody is chopping a tree, and person A is chopping a tree. Person B pushes person C into the path of the axe, and the guy gets killed.
Right. Well, there, person C will be liable. The person who is swinging the axe will be liable because he directly harmed this person.
Okay, let's say somebody's practicing neck throwing or something to the point where. At the time that the action happened, there was no person in the way, and then you push somebody in, and he's...
Right, so that case is actually discussed. They talk about it in terms of shooting an arrow.
Yeah.
So if you shoot the arrow, and then somebody comes in. And again, I want to think before I respond to it. I'm not sure, so I'd rather look it up and give you, the right answer. Otherwise, I'm into this professional malpractice category also.
Example of the guy's on the ladder and he drops his hammer and it kills somebody and he
goes
to the city of refuge.
Correct. The question is, though, would he have a civil suit against him? That's really where we're going with it. Take a look at source number 7. I want to make sure this is clear, that there's liability between the vandal or the attacker and God. It's not as though he's right for doing what he did. They give the case there of somebody who shouts in somebody else's ear and makes him deaf. And that they consider to be indirect harm as well. And said he's not liable in human courts, but he's chayav b'dinei shamayim. He's liable in heavenly law. God says, no, I don't want you doing this. It just happens to be that human courts are not authorized to punish for it. Yeah.
Yeah, we see this in Tachanun, where one of the things that we say is forgive bad advice.
Yes, Ya'atz Nura. Correct. That's one of the things that we ask God to forgive us for. Although there it's also potentially concerned for intentional bad advice, which is another...
Yeah, but if there was nothing wrong between you and God for doing it, you wouldn't have to mention it
right.
at all.
True. So one might argue bad advice is grama. It's indirect. Meaning I told him I think Apple's going to go up. But he went and invested. It's surely separate from my advice. I only was involved indirectly. But take a look, please, at source number 8, which is the key to this discussion. Source number 8 is a Talmudic passage regarding money changers. Now, money changers don't think booth in the airport. Money changers were responsible to, and they were often actually government authorized, to change currencies as well as to track currencies to make sure that the coins were actually valid. So if I'm in a business transaction with somebody and they offer me a coin and I'm not sure whether it is valid or not, I go to the money changer. And the money changer says, yes, you should accept this, or no, you shouldn't accept it. And on that basis, you're going to engage in the transaction or choose not to. And remember also that coins were more challenging in their day because it wasn't an issue of what's the face on it. It was an issue potentially of the weight of the coin and had it become, had it deteriorated so that it was no longer the proper weight. So we get this passage here in the Talmud. If one shows a coin to a money changer, and I added the words that are in brackets, you show a coin to a money changer, and the money changer says, yeah, that one's good. And you accept it from the party, and then later on you try to spend it, and it's rejected. So we have two different sources. Tanichada, one source teaches that an expert would be exempt, but a non-expert would be liable. An expert would be exempt, a non-expert would be liable. Why is that?
So
person showing the coin is the...
No. The money changer. The money changer is evaluating it.
Is the expert or the non-expert.
Or the expert or non-expert, as the case may be, yeah.
The expert is giving his expert opinion. He turned out to be wrong, but he was doing everything he was supposed to be doing. He just was wrong. The non-expert, he's not minding his own business. He's intervening where he shouldn't. He shouldn't be giving an opinion on the validity of the coin. He's not an expert. He should have stayed out of it.
Right. Exactly.
He should have sought his advice in the first place.
And the answer is no, but he is responsible not to give bad advice. That goes back to the stumbling block. So what we're seeing here is the expert did what he had to do. He got proper training. He got certified. They told him, you're good to go. So he gave his advice, and it happened not to be correct. But he did what he could. We're assuming no negligence involved. The non-expert, on the other hand, had no business giving an opinion. That's the first approach. Second approach, another source teaches that any money changer would be liable. The non-expert is going to be liable, and the expert will be liable. So we have competing opinions. Rav Papa, a sage from the Gemara, so we're talking about, he is at ballpark at about 1600 years ago. Rav Papa said, the view that exempts an expert refers to somebody like Danko and Isur, who were two people who were known to Rav Papa, who were over-the-top experts. They lacked no knowledge. The only time they would make a mistake is if a coin was newly minted, and so therefore they hadn't had the opportunity to learn about it. But other than that, everything is right. So if Papa says, that's someone who's exempt, because he really has done absolutely everything. If you're not perfect, you don't get to give an opinion on it. That's what he says. But then we get a story, and we get two stories, actually. First story. A woman showed a coin to Rabbi Chiya, and I added in brackets, Rabbi Chiya is expert and is not paid. That's what we're talking about. So he's an expert, he's not being paid to give his opinion. And he approved it. He said, yeah, this coin is good. The next day she told him, I showed it to others who rejected it, and I couldn't spend it. In other words, I went on your say-so, I accepted the coin, and then when I tried to use it, they wouldn't take it. Rabbi Chiya told Rav, exchange it for her, and record it as a bad deal. Write it off. It's just, you know, this is the cost of doing business. But Rabbi Chiya, the Talmud challenges, was as expert as Danko and Isser. He was known for his expertise. So therefore, he shouldn't be liable. To which they answer, true. He did this to transcend his legal obligation. He wasn't obligated to pay. But he felt bad. It was his mistake. And he said, I'll make it up to her. That's that's story number one. Yeah?
Just a quick question. Who's Rav in this case? Why is Rabbi Chiya telling Rav to exchange
it? Right. Rav is Rabbi Chiya's nephew. He's his nephew on both sides.
But why is Rav involved in this deal at all?
Only because he's working for Rabbi Chiya.
Oh, okay. He's acting on his behalf. Okay, I thought he was involved.
Yeah. No, he was actually if you look in the beginning of Pesachim, he is his nephew on both sides due to a marriage of step siblings. His father and his mother are both siblings of Rabbi Chiya. So there's a very close relationship there. So in any case, Rabbi Chiya says to Rav, take care of this. Clean it up. And yes, it's not really my mess, but clean it up anyway. That's what he orders. Second story. Reish Lakish, who is one of the sages, showed a coin to Rabbi Elazar, who was not expert, it seems. And Rabbi Elazar approved it. He said, yeah, that's a good coin. Reish Lakish said to him, see, I depend on you. Meaning, I'm going to accept this coin because you say so. Rabbi Elazar replied, what does that mean? If you wish to be able to exchange it in the event that it is found to be bad, meaning if you're saying I'm depending on you because you want me to be liable, haven't you yourself said that liability would be the view of Rabbi Meir, who punishes for garmi, implying that we don't agree with Rabbi Meir? There is indeed a school of thought that says you're liable for this. This is called garmi, the other type of indirect harm. But that's only Rabbi Meir's view, and it's not ours. And therefore, even if you say, I am relying on you, I'm still not liable. That was Rabbi Elazar's objection. To which Rabbi Reish Lakish responds, no. It is Rabbi Meir who says that, and we agree with Rabbi Meir. That's what I meant to say about this. So what we see in this second story is that there is liability. There wasn't in Rabbi Chiya's case, for reasons we have to discuss, maybe just because he was an expert. But we see in this latter case that there is, generally, there is responsibility for somebody who gives bad advice in this money changer case. You told them it was good, it wasn't good, you weren't an expert, you're going to be liable for it. You follow? However, he takes the step of saying, see, I depend on you. What does he accomplish by doing that?
He's basing his decisions on what's going to help.
Right. And why does that help him?
That's a little bit of bonus on the plus.
But it tells him he's serious. Right? Go back to our case of Ari and David, right? Ari the neurosurgeon. Ari the neurosurgeon could easily say, this was Sunday morning after Minyan. I didn't expect that you were going to take this seriously and do a trade on that basis. I'm a neurosurgeon. I'm not a stockbroker. You didn't come into my office. It's not like there's any reason to think you were serious. So yeah, I didn't give you the best possible advice. But if he says to him, I'm going to buy based on your recommendation, then Ari has a responsibility to either say, I don't know what I'm talking about, or to improve his recommendation. That's the difference with this, with the liability. So what emerges from this, and I noted it in source number 9 from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law, is that there is liability for this kind of indirect harm called garmi, even though there wasn't for pulling away the pillows under grama. No liability for grama, yes liability for garmi. You follow?
I don't get the distinction.
And that's the problem, is what in the world is the distinction between the two? So we're going to come back to that in a second. But to sum up what we've said, there is liability if a person gives bad advice negligently, as in the case where he didn't train for it. He's not an expert. If he trained for it, then he may be protected. The layperson is by definition negligent because he gave advice without knowing what he was talking about. But his liability may depend on him being told, I am relying on you. So what is the difference between grama and garmi? Two different approaches. One approach is that garmi is more direct than grama. It depends how directly you caused harm to the other. Now, you'll say pulling away the cushions was fairly direct because it caused the glass to break. But to get an understanding of what kind of direct we mean, source number 11 from Rashbam says, people sell wheat. There are pebbles there in the wheat. They sell wheat by volume. You are going to do them a favor. You're going to dig out all of the pebbles, right? Or you go to the supermarket, and the supermarket, let's say they're selling, they're selling onions by weight. And you say, I'm going to do everybody a favor. I'm going to strip off the outer shells and skins that are on the onions, and everybody will be very happy. But the supermarket won't be happy because they were charging people for that. So, in the event that you do that, Rashbam, source number 11, says, that's direct harm. That's garmi. That is considered to be more direct harm because now he's going to have to supply wheat to take the place of the pebbles. That's the type of harm that you're going to be liable for. Here, the guy's depending on you. He's accepting the coin because you said it was good. That's considered direct harm. That's one explanation for why one would be liable in a garmi case. The other explanation, which frankly I find to be more consistent, is that you can't draw lines between grama and garmi. They're both indirect harm. However, garmi cases are cases that are more common. And the rabbi said, we're going to create a rabbinic decree saying you are liable. You shouldn't be liable. They're both indirect. However, you can't have people running around and giving bad advice and harming people and saying, well, it was indirect. So therefore, in certain cases, we're going to label those garmi and we're going to bring people under control. If you take a look at source number 12, Rabbi Shabtai HaKohen, the Shach, takes this position. He writes, the sages find when they judged a circumstance to be common, like this case, and one cannot compare decrees. You can't say, I'm going to extend this to apply to a new case. In certain cases, they said, you're liable because we want to prevent impropriety. And so that may be what's going on here with the bad advice. It's just as indirect as anything else, but it's very common, and therefore they said we need to rein it in. So, in practice, we apply the tort of negligence due to garmi if the people rely on you and you didn't take adequate precautions to thwart impropriety. That's the that are adequate precautions to make sure that what you said was correct. I brought you source number 13. Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, author of the Pitei Choshen, was a judge on Israeli rabbinical courts until he passed away a few years ago. His work, Pitei Choshen, is a landmark work on business ethics and financial law. So he writes, an investment advisor who advises to make a bad investment would appear to be liable under the law of one who shows a dinar to a money changer. He says it's the same thing. The investment advisor is also going to be liable under the law of Garmi. And so...
Didn't we say the money changer
came
before the
Chia? So Rabbi Chia was exempt because the money changer is not always going to be liable. He'll only be liable sometimes. If you take a look at 14, that's exactly where I'm going. Source number 14, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, gives us its rulings based on that passage of Gemara, that piece from the Talmud that we saw. And it says, if you show a coin to a money changer, the money changer says it's fine, and then the coin turns out to be bad, then the following rules apply. If the money changer was paid, he must pay. He has to pay for it, even if he is a full expert. If he's paid, he's going to be liable. Now, the truth is, we didn't see any discussion about paid or unpaid explicitly in the Talmudic discussion. Why would payment make him more liable? Good. You gave the answer. Hold that question. I'm going to hold that answer. I'm going to come back to this case now. You're supposed to say, I don't know, but fine. I'll come back to that. If the money changer saw it for free, and so he's not paid, and he is a full expert, he's exempt. There's no liability for him. He already did his training, and that was sufficient. If the money changer is not expert, he has to pay whether he has to pay for it, whether he saw it for free or whether he was being paid. If the customer says to him, "I'm depending on you," or circumstances demonstrate that he depended on him, that's good enough. And so I summed it up in number 15 because that text is a little bit confusing. So I gave you a little table here in number 15. If he's an expert and he's paid, he's liable. If he's an expert and he's not paid, he's not liable. He's got the training. If he's not an expert, he's a layperson, and he was paid, he's liable. If he's a layperson and he's not paid, he's not liable unless the client said, "I am relying on you."
Shouldn't there be a general presumption that someone's asking advice because they're hoping to act on it?
Is that true? Do you always ask advice because you're planning on... you're schmoozing with somebody.
If I didn't plan on acting on it, I wouldn't ask for that advice.
No, you never have a situation in which you're just talking to somebody and you say, "I've been thinking about such and such. What do you think?"
But it means that you're putting value to it, to what the person wants.
Maybe.
I have people who will ask my paralegal advice and try to, they don't listen to what I say. They hear it.
Well, that's another story where people ask for professional advice and they're not paying attention. That's another story.
But is this not doing the whole point of a person providing the service or asking the advice? What is their level of knowledge and ability to act on that? Does that factor into any of these things? It says I'm depending on you, then clearly there's a different responsibility than someone just randomly asking, "What do you think about?" And they may have varying levels. Does it change the duty of care depending on the knowledge and skill level of your client?
And the answer is quite possibly. You know, if as a layperson, you could make the argument that this guy's not serious, he's just having a nice conversation. If we're going to an expert, then already this is more serious and more likely that I'm relying on him. Yes, that could be a distinction. Jacob?
One could very easily come up with an example where you're not relying on someone. Let's say you're curious about the comings and goings of a particular company. You say, "Well, what do you think about Apple? You think it's going to be a good buy? You have no money. You're not planning on investing, but you follow these things because you're curious."
Mm-hmm.
Somebody says, "Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great buy." And then you think, "Okay, maybe I should do something about it." You borrow money, you buy, and then based on that, you decide to buy.
By the time that you asked,
it seemed like it was serious. So you can very easily come up with an example where you're just talking to somebody and somebody might give advice, and it is what it is.
Yeah. No, and I think in that situation, he has a right to interpret it based on the conversation at that time and not what may happen down the road. But take a look at source 16, because I think this is key in understanding the 16 and 17. Abichiel Michal Epstein in his Aruch HaShulchan says the following. If the money changer is not expert, then he's liable if the client told the money changer, I depend on you. Or if his words demonstrate that he depends entirely on his examination. He may have said something else. Otherwise, we should not hold the money changer liable, since he can say, I didn't know you would depend on me alone. I thought you would ask others, and so I wasn't very careful. And some say the money changer is liable even if the person did not say, I depend on you, since he takes payment. If he's being paid, that shows that it's serious. The client certainly depends on him entirely. And here, he gets to the point of why the expert is liable if he's paid. This liability is from Garmi. And when paid, his liability is as a paid guardian. And what he's talking about, I'm going to skip 17 for a second and show you source number 18.
Can I ask you one question?
Yeah.
Because in many cases what happens, professionals are reached out to, you're doing business, and you are not the expert, but you're a general advisor. And what happens is, and you may get paid, but you're not the expert. So they come to you and they say, here's the situation. You may say, well, look, I'm not the expert, but I think you need to do this and this. Okay, but you need to go and rely on that person because I can't give you. If I'm in your shoes, I can't make that decision for you. You have to make the judgment call.
Right.
So you could be a layperson, you could be seen as a layperson, or you could be perceived as an expert.
Right.
But either way, you're qualifying saying I'm not the expert. There's actually another specialist.
Right. So I think your qualifier works as long as it's serious. And that's the key, is really the seriousness of the qualification. Meaning, when they say on the commercials, past performance is not an indication of future results, no one believes that. I'm sorry, it's true. No one believes that. If you really believed that, you wouldn't ask for advice in the first place. So that doesn't work. You know, a qualifier needs to be backed up by something. You need to give reasons why. You know, like, I don't have training in this particular area, something like that.
And you're giving a specific pearl to an expert who specializes in a particular field.
Right. No, I would agree with that. But take a look at 18. Rabbi Zera says, if a person gives his animal to a butcher at a shacht, he wants the butcher to be liable, give him a dinar first. Give him some money before that. And the idea of giving him money, as noted in 19, is... And he applies it to the money changers. This is from the Shita Mekubetzes. He says, the idea is that when someone gives the money, he is essentially saying to you, you have a higher standard of care now. You are responsible to do more for me. And we compare it to the Shomer discussion, even though it's not literally the same. And that's what you had said before. Shomer is a guardian. The Torah outlines three separate types of guardian relationships where someone's guarding my property. People call it four, but it's really three for our purposes. One is where someone's doing me a favor. And if he's doing me a favor, he's guarding my object for free. I'm going away, I said, him, watch my house. Right? So he has minimal liability. He has to not be careless, and then he's fine. Because I'm getting all the benefit. He's guarding my property for free. Opposite extreme is where I am getting all the benefit from him, where he's getting all the benefit from me. The case in which he borrows something from me. He asks me, he'd like to borrow my watch. He's not going to pay me for it. He's going to get to use it. He has maximum liability because he is the beneficiary and I'm getting nothing. The intermediate case is a case where there's benefit going both ways, such as where he rents the watch from me, so he gets the watch, but I get paid. Or he pays, or I'm paying him to guard something for me. I pay him to watch my house. In that case, there's mutual benefit, and therefore he has some liability. And what we're saying here is, if you pay somebody to be the money changer, then, or not the money changer, to be the money expert, to be the examiner, then he has a higher degree of liability. And even though if he was watching it for free, if he was examining my coin for free, we would say he's not liable, because he did what he had to do by becoming an expert. If I'm paying him for it, there's actually a higher duty of care involved. So there are tiers to the duty of care within halacha. There's the duty of care expected if there's no money changing hands, and then there's a higher duty of care in the event that there is money changing hands. So that's the distinction that we're drawing here. Go back for a second, please, to number 17, and I want to show you from a secular law perspective. From this case, Queen v. Cognos, where Judges Sopinka, and I assume this is Jacobucci, but I'm not really sure, the tort of negligent misrepresentation, right? Presenting false information because of negligence, is an established principle of Canadian tort law. There are five general requirements for a successful claim. One, there must be a duty of care based on a special relationship between the representor, the person giving the information, and the representee. Two, the representation in question must be untrue, inaccurate, or misleading. Three, the representer must have acted negligently in making the misrepresentation. Four, the representee must have relied in a reasonable manner on the negligent misrepresentation. And five, the reliance must have been detrimental. But the key here is, you have to know that this person is relying on him. It's very parallel to what you're seeing within the halachic system. There has to be a sense of, this person is relying on me, and if so, then I have a duty of care. But the only substantive difference I'm seeing is that within the system, within halacha, being paid actually creates a higher duty of care that I really didn't see in this, although I'm not an expert in the secular law. It could be that there is such a phenomenon there as well. But what emerges from this is that there is a standard of making sure you're giving good advice to anybody who may be relying on you. You have a duty of care, even if there's no professional relationship, it doesn't make a difference. In the event that you don't get proper expertise and you don't give a qualifier, something goes wrong, you will be liable, even though the harm is indirect, under the principle of garmi. That's the one sentence wrap-up of what we've said. Now, I have another piece that takes about 5 minutes. I don't know if people have to leave, you can go. But it's a 5-minute piece that I think is worth knowing about. There's been a change in the secular law over the last few years. I think we resolved case one and case two. Case one is the friends who are speaking casually. And so now we understand he's negligent for not getting training, but he's not liable unless the friend says to him, I'm relying on you. Case number two, the professional advisor is going to be liable if he's paid for making a mistake. If he'll be liable, and if he did not, and if he was not paid, then he'll have a lower threshold because he did get the expertise. Okay, so case number three is my last piece here. Robin is a professional certified investment advisor, and Sam retains Robin's services. Robin advises Sam to purchase gold because Robin expects the commodity to recover strongly in 2 years. Sam was chasing immediate returns, though, as Sam needs that investment money to marry off a daughter in a year. Is Robin responsible for having given inappropriate advice?
What did Sam say to her?
Sam said, I'm looking for a good investment. Sam did not give enough information.
She gave proper advice. It is going to happen. It's just not what Sam wanted while he was thinking that. He thought maybe Robin was also a seer or a mind reader at the same time.
That's one way to look at it.
Robin is supposed to find out these things. So it's her obligation as a professional investment advisor to find out what you need the money, what your financial situation is, what type of investor you are, what this money is.
So we have two opposite points of view. One of you says you only need the information the person gave you and your answer has to be based on that. The other approach saying the investment advisor has to find out and has to dig. Jacob?
Yeah. I was going to do something like that, but I was just going to add the point that the advice actually depends on that information. So by virtue of the fact that you didn't, that the advice will actually change depending on that missing piece of information. And given that the advisor did not ask for that missing piece of information, I would say that would constitute negligence on the part of the advisor.
Mm. Robin didn't actually disclose that I'm expecting this in 2 years, right? She would have said that, right, to Sam. Then, right? Then he would have been able to say, well, no, actually, that doesn't work for me because.
Well, take a look at source number 20, please. This is from the Investment Industry Regulatory Organization of Canada. Each dealer member, when recommending to a client the purchase, sale, exchange, or holding of any security, shall use due diligence to ensure that the recommendation is suitable for such client based on factors including the client's current financial situation, investment knowledge, investment objectives and time horizon, risk tolerance, and the account or account's current investment portfolio composition and risk level. And they go on to say that you have to have them fill out a form and it has to say what they want and how long they want it for and what kind of returns they want, the level of risk they can tolerate, and so forth. I remember the first time that I dealt with an advisor who asked me those questions, and I thought it was really great that they were doing this. Like, they're really interested in knowing, and I didn't know the answer to the questions, but they, I thought it was great that they were asking, not realizing that, yeah, this is called the law. If you want to be certified, you actually have to meet that. This is investment advice is internally regulated as a profession, and that is in fact the rule. You have to make sure, and this is what's called know your client. That's the that's what this comes under. It's relatively new in Canada in the last few decades that this became a requirement, but there have been legal decisions that have been issued on this basis of you didn't properly find out what the client needed and the client wanted, and therefore you're going to be responsible. So the question is, does this exist within Judaism? Does Judaism say, you gave good advice, buy gold, I'm pretending now, please don't take this as advice, I'm neither neurosurgeon nor investment advisor, but it made sense because it's at historic lows and it always goes up, so therefore I think it's a good idea, without knowing the specifics of this person's position. So first of all, clearly, you know, the principle of dina de malchusa dina, that the law of the land is the law, is going to be important here. It sets expectations, meaning one Jew saying to another Jew, I'm giving you advice, has to recognize that the other Jew's background in this, and even non-Jew, we talked about within the discussion of Lifnei Iver, of, you know, the stumbling block, but he has to know the other person's expectations are framed by whatever the law is and whatever is regulating the profession. So you could say, well, Jewish law only says give good advice. It didn't say I have to find out and dig. But if he's expecting it because that's the industry standard, you're out of luck. That's point number one. Point number two takes us back to source number three on the sheet and a key word that was there in the Hebrew and I translated in the English. It says, if somebody is taking advice from you, don't give him etzah she'eina hogenes lo. Don't give him advice that's inappropriate for him. And all those who write on this area emphasize the him. There has to be advice that's right for that person. On the other hand, much of the literature focuses on distinguishing between advice that's right for the recipient and advice that's good for the giver. In other words, emphasizing advice that's good for the recipient may not mean to exclude advice that's good in general. It might mean to exclude self-serving advice, such as where you tell him, go sell your field, you should go buy a donkey for it, because you want to buy his field. Right? That sort of a piece of advice is bad, not because it was bad advice for him personally, it's because it was self-serving advice. So it's hard, even though it emphasizes advice is bad for him, I'm not sure that that's conclusive proof that you have an obligation to actually dig and find out. I was mulling this, and I sent it to Rabbi Baruch Weintraub. For those of you who remember, he was the Skan. He was with our Beit Midrash for a couple of years, and he's a very creative thinker. So I floated the question to him of, is there an obligation or not? So he came up with one thought. If you take a look at the last source on the sheet, a passage from the Talmud, talking about the mitzvah of yibum / chalitza. In a nutshell, if a man dies without having any children, and he was married, his widow can marry his brother. In the event that they marry, it's called yibum. It was a historic practice even before the Torah was given as a means of protecting widows. They would come into the family and be taken care of. However, they have the option also of doing chalitza, of splitting up, and saying, we're not going to do this. So if you take a look at source number 21, the Torah, in presenting this law, says, v'dibru elav, that the sages, the rabbinical court that's present, should speak to this person, should speak to the guy. What are they saying to him? So the Talmud says, they give him advice that suits him. If he is young and she is old, or he is old and she is young, they try to, you know, discourage him. They say to him, why would you be with her? It's going to create strife. They try to give him advice that's appropriate for him. Not just good advice in general, but something that will suit the people who are actually involved. So he thought to say that that shows that we look into a person's particular situation. It's an interesting source. And I think there's other material you could draw on to try to demonstrate that. For example, one of the classic Talmudic examples of putting a stumbling block in front of the blind is if somebody is a Nazir, they swore they would not drink wine, and you give them a cup of wine, right? So now you have given advice, so to speak. You put a stumbling block in front of somebody. And in that case, it's only bad because of who he is. Normally, handing people a cup of wine is a nice thing to do. giving it to someone who's alcoholic or giving it to a nazir is a very bad thing to do. So you do have to know who you are dealing with and act in a way that's appropriate for that person. But I'm not really sure whether Jewish law would really require that you dig in order to get information, in order to make sure that it's right for that particular individual. The jury's out. I think there are sources you can bring on it, but I think it's something worth thinking about. From the standpoint of secular law, if you don't do it, that's actually considered to be negligent. Clear? Thank you very much.
Thank you.